Blog Talk Radio.
Episode of the Story Blender. Yes, we know we are a day late. This is Saturday night that this show is going on, but that's okay. We had a little technical issues yesterday, but we're glad to bring the show to you today. Steven has a wonderful guest on and a wonderful co-host, I gotta tell you. His guest is none other than author Jerry Jenkins. He is the author of 21 New York Times bestsellers, seven of them debuting at number one. Over 186 books with 70 million copies sold. And his biggest series is the Left Behind series, which I'm sure that you might know. Nicolas Cage, Kirk Cameron involved in those. He's got a lot of stuff to talk about. And I was most gracious to be able to be co-hosting with him, with Stephen, on this show. So it's fabulous interview, and I know you guys are going to love it. But first, we have to tell you about a couple other things here. And that is that Janet Cole writes what she knows, the world of big law lawyers and clients. Her new book is a mystery called The Smell of Money. In the book, she pairs a disgruntled law partner with a contract killer having a midlife crisis. They have a common client, an old woman whose ruthlessness includes her need to kill opponents, and they meet when the killer's next target is the lawyer's daughter. You can go right now to Amazon and get it, and you can also visit coleslaw.com. That's Cole with a K. Also, of course, all of our shows this year are brought to you by Kensington Books, and you can go to kensingtonbooks.com for Daniel Palmer, Kevin O'Brien, Lisa Jackson, and many, many more. I just read Kevin O'Brien's latest book, which comes out at the end of July, and he's going to be on the radio show, and it is freaking fantastic. It's called You'll Miss Me When I'm Gone, so look out for that one. Betty Jean Craig has a new book out called Fairfield's Auction. It's the latest book in her Witherstone mystery series. You can visit BettyJeanCraig.com. That's Craig with an E for more information. Also, Crooked Lane Books wants to know if you're ready for a thrill. You can check out their great books, including Leslie Karst, Anna Carlisle, Wendy Corsi Staub, and more, by visiting CrookedLaneBooks.com. Impossible to Put Down, says best-selling author Lois Duncan about Annabelle Lee, the latest book by Mike Napa. Visit coffeeandhillseries.com. That's coffee, C-O-F-F-E-Y, and hillseries.com. So now we're going to leave it up to my good friend, Mr. Stephen James. And here we go with the Story Blender. So Stephen and myself, take it away.
Welcome to the Story Blender. I'm Stephen James, and this is where great storytellers share the secrets of great storytelling. And today I'm honored to have a guest host who is a huge fan of, an advocate for great fiction, especially suspense in all its different forms. John Robb and his wife run Suspense Publishing, as well as Suspense Magazine, Suspense Radio. And John, thanks for being here today.
Oh, Stephen, thank you so much for asking me. It's a pleasure. Love the show, of course. I've been doing this for, a year and a half now, and now I'm finally on with you. So instead of, I think it's fabulous, and I think what you do with the storytelling and how you dive into it and take it to another level is fascinating for not only authors but for fans and readers to get more inside scoop. So thank you.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And, John, I don't know if you remember, but I think we first connected about 10 years ago when you reviewed my novel, The Night.
Yes, and the candle scene.
Yeah, that's so funny. That's what I was going to say, is I think it was the candle scene or something.
Yep.
So, but I'm glad our paths crossed. And
absolutely.
And it's good to have you here. And we have an amazing guest today on the show. Jerry B. Jenkins is the author of, and I am not making this up, more than 185 books,
Jeez.
Including 21 New York Times bestsellers. The Left Behind series alone, which he co-wrote with Tim LaHaye, has sold more than 70 million copies, inspired a number of movies, the latest one starring Nicolas Cage. Recently, Jerry has been focusing more of his energy on teaching the next generation of writers the keys to great writing through his institutes, his courses, his seminars. And And I first met Jerry a number of years ago when we were both teaching at a writer's conference in North Carolina. And he's a very humble man and one of the most dedicated and hardworking writers I've ever met. And so, Jerry, thanks so much for being on our show today.
Hey, thanks for having me. Good to be with you.
Hi, Jerry. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
Yeah, years ago, I think it was maybe 2000 or 2001, I went to a writer's conference as a participant, and they had a contest at this place, and they said, you know, write the title of a book that you could do that would be a bestseller, and the best title would get a free book or something. So I was like, all right, I'll make up a title. And I decided to make up a title that was based on two of the current trends in publishing, and I ended up winning a book. Here's the title. See if you like it. Chicken Soup for the Left Behind Soul. What do you think? Would that fly?
You know, since then, people have gone crazy with that title and added to it. And I've had people send me titles like Chicken Soup for the Left Behind Amish Vampire. And it just keeps going, you know.
It probably never stops, so. I also, I think we might have another connection. I'm not sure if you're still involved with Moody Bible Institute, but my daughter actually goes to school up there right now.
Is that right? And, well, I just finished my seventh year as chairman of the Board of Trustees, and now I'm just a regular trustee, which is a lot easier. But, yeah, I've been involved with Moody since I started there as a 17-year-old freshman in 1967. Yeah, I worked there for 30 years, and then I've been on the board for 15 years, and it's just been great. Yeah. But I did
so, Jerry, how do you help on the board of colleges, also teach other writers in your courses, plus, you know, keynote and speak at numerous events, and still have time to write 185 books?
How 185. I don't even know if I could give you 185 book names off the top of my head. And I'm in the freaking business.
I have three grown sons, and they always kid me. They say, Dad, we're pretty sure you've written more books than you've ever read. But, you know, it may sound like I'm being falsely modest, but I don't sing or dance or preach. I consider myself mono-gifted, and I have lots of friends that are multi-gifted, and they do all this other stuff. And I say, you know, I feel obligated because I only have this one gift that I really should exercise it. And so I'm pretty well compartmentalized. When my kids were little and growing up, I was determined not to lose my family to my gift or to my calling. And so I never wrote when my kids were at home and awake. So I never wrote with guilt. I spent the time, I prioritized the family. And the kids never became prodigals or rebels. They're my best friends to this day. I courted and dated my wife. We've been married 45 years and we're deliriously happy. And so when I did write, I didn't have that guilt, and so I became very productive in the short time I had. And then when I went full-time freelance, I just went nuts, you know. I mean, it was great fun. So I try to be really productive, and I do write fast because my background was in journalism. I was a sports writer and stuff like that. So I just try to maintain priorities. I still am a procrastinator, though. I've done blogs on how procrastination helped me do this, you know.
But you finished those blogs, right?
I believe it or not, yeah, that's the difference, is that, you know, you can procrastinate as long as you keep your deadlines sacred,
right,
and finally do get to it, yeah.
Well, I think I may have read, I was looking for it online, actually, before the interview, and I couldn't find it, but I think I was first introduced to one of your books maybe 25 or even 30 years ago, and I think, I have a sense that it was about demon possession, but it was a nonfiction book. And I could not lay my hands on the title. Does that sound like something you may have written?
It does not. Sorry.
No, it is one that you wrote. It was like 186, but no.
Demon Physician, I don't...
Yeah, I couldn't remember. I was like, I think he may have written it, but I couldn't locate, put my finger on it, so...
You know, it's really funny. I get blamed for books that I haven't read or even credited with books I haven't written. One time I had a guy come up to me at the Christian Booksellers Convention, and he was in tears, and he thanked me for my years of writing and all the books he'd read that had meant so much to him, and he just, you know, so appreciated it. And I was very moved. I said, well, thanks so much. I really appreciate it. I said, what's your name? He said, my name's John. I said, well, John, Thanks so much. That means a lot to me because writing is a solitary profession and you don't hear too often, you know, enough from readers. So thanks so much for sharing that with me. And he said, well, thank you, Larry.
Larry.
I have no idea who he thought I was.
Larry.
Oh, that's hilarious.
I once got thanked, too, for a book. A woman gave me a note. She was speechless to get, you know, the privilege of meeting me. You know, it was such an honor. And so she just gave me a note and rushed away. And she thanked me for this book title that she was so thrilled with, and it was a book by Jerry Bridges, the head of Navigator.
Oh, Jerry Bridges.
I had interviewed, and this is Mark Greaney, who now writes for the Tom Clancy, and he was talking about how when he sits down, I mean, he does book signings because, of course, Tom Clancy passed away a few years ago, and there'll be people that will literally come up and think he's Tom Clancy.
Oh, yeah.
And he's like, he goes, I need to buy a shirt that says, no, I'm not Tom Clancy. Because you'll see reviews, too, where people will write and say, oh, Tom's done it again. And it's like, no, Tom hasn't done it in a long time. But, yeah, so I'm sure and when you write that many books and you write in such a genre that, you know, you're very much known for, people probably will get, you know, work confused with other people. And I think that that's, you know, and not always just for funny stories. You just hear a lot of funny stories when that happens.
Yeah, and I think that's one way that you stay humble, too, because, you know, people credit you for things you haven't done. I've got a friend whose name is Rick Warren, but he's not that Rick Warren, not the one.
I was going to say, I heard of Rick Warren, but no, he's not that one.
And this guy actually has a website called The Other Rick Warren, and he's got a picture on it, and he says, you know, I've got a job, I own a factory, and I've got a business, but I'm not that Rick Warren. And he speaks everywhere, and he tells the story about how he's always mistaken for Rick Warren. And he said he did this recently, and after he did that and spoke and told that story, a woman came up to him and said, your book, The Purpose-Driven Life, just meant so much to me. And he goes, were you listening? I'm not that Rick Warren.
People hear what they, you know, what they want to hear, and
they do.
They tune out the rest, and... I was just thinking of years ago. I was in Kazakhstan actually teaching writing, and there was a group that was it was a Christian group that had started doing camps at all of these places where it used to be communist youth camps back in the days of the Soviet Union. And so at these places where really Christians had been persecuted back in the day, well, now they were hosting these Christian camps. And so I was doing some training for people leading it on creative storytelling and teaching and this sort of thing. So I came back and I told someone from our church, and afterwards, a little while later, he came up to me and said, man, I have to tell you, I'm a little upset with you. I was like, why? He's like, why are you teaching at communist youth camps? I'm like, no, listen. Somewhere along the line, you missed the whole point of what I was trying to say.
Because I've been converted to communism, did you?
Exactly.
Yeah, because communism is a religion.
Yeah.
So Jerry, you're most known for your fiction. You have done lots of nonfiction, but you are most known for the fiction, and some people would call your books inspirational thrillers or inspirational or maybe supernatural suspense. Is there a way that you look at your own work? Is there a phrase or something that you prefer to use to describe most of the thrillers that you tend to write?
Well, I tend to be fairly eclectic, and one of the drawbacks of being so known for one genre is that people don't even realize sometimes some of the other stuff you've done.
Yeah.
When people ask me to name my favorites of what I've done, Left Behind falls in the top 10 probably, because obviously it's sort of made my life as far as materially speaking. But I would say my favorite novel I've ever written is one called Riven, which is a contemporary, and it's about a guy on death row, and, you know, and then I've written a lot of biblical fiction. I've done two books about the Apostle Paul. I did four novels based on the Gospels. So I've done everything from futuristic. I've got one coming out the last day of this month called The Valley of the Dry Bones, and it's set 10 years in the future, and the premise is that the drought in California has continued to the point where the whole state is uninhabitable. So it's sort of like The Walking Dead meets Left Behind. You got
whoa. I'm in L.A. right now. Please don't say that.
If you're still there,
do not want to be part of your story.
Yeah. If you're still there in 10 years, you're going to be part of my little band of holdouts, you know?
Oh, my Lord.
But see, that, you know, that, so that's kind of a dystopian thing. So I do really eclectic fiction, but people think, you know, I've been interviewed by people who say, have you ever written anything other than Left Behind? Because that's all they know, you know?
Yeah.
So I try to, you know, I just like to write stuff that I would like to read, something that will keep me turning the pages, so character-driven stuff. And then I've got cop thrillers. I'm from a family of law enforcement officers. I'm the first adult male in my family who was not a cop. My dad was a police chief. My two older brothers were career law enforcement officers. And so it was only, you know, maybe 5 years ago that I did a trilogy called Precinct 11. It's about Chicago cops. And I felt like I owed it to my family to do this because I used to, you know, watch police procedural shows with my dad and brothers. And they would laugh at how everything's solved in an hour when it takes months of, you know, painstaking.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they would want all the procedural stuff to be right, and they'd want the weaponry to be right, and that type of thing. And I thought, well, I'm gonna do these. You know, they have to be taught, and they have to be page turners. But I want the detail to be right, so that if I get letters from cops, they aren't saying, "Hey, that gun would never do that. This guy would never ask that question." They
absolutely, yeah.
And so it's been really gratifying to get good letters from that where, you know, cops will say, were you a cop or do you know cops or did you have good consultants? So that was
Oh, that's great, yeah.
So as far as what I would call it, I probably am too eclectic to call it any one thing, but I want to write page turners and I want to write commercials.
But I have to say, I am happy that you said Riven because that's the book I have sitting on my desk right now, and I was glad that that's your favorite because I didn't want to go out and buy 184 other books to read.
You want to just go to the greatest hits first.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Yeah, and the good news on that one is, even though it's probably coming up on almost 10 years old now, but we've got serious film interest in that now, so it's probably going to be
the
next 2 or 3 years. I'm pretty excited.
Oh, fantastic. Great.
Now, one thing, Jerry, I want to kind of jump in because this kind of leads into the question, is that what you said before is that good fiction must be entertaining, but what makes fiction special and true is that the realness of a novel allows it to carry a larger message. So when you can emphasize both entertainment and truth, how do those kind of fit together nicely in great fiction?
Well, it's so true that you have to marry the two, and anytime one gets, you know, overwhelms the other, it doesn't work. And you know, I'm teaching writers now, as you mentioned, and you know, I owned the Christian Writers Guild for probably 13 years, and now I've got just the Jerry Jenkins Writers Guild. And it's exploded because I'm teaching only online now at jerrysgift.com. But I try to tell people, and especially beginners get this wrong, they want to write a book that's just totally a message.
Mm.
It's fiction, but they want to make this point, whatever it is. They're pro-life or they're pro-whatever. And that's what comes through. And what you're seeing is a sermon that is masquerading as a novel. And people read about 4 pages and go, oh, I get it, you know, you've got a message. Well, every novelist has a message. I read, you know, general market novels, and they've got something to say, too. And most of them don't even apologize for it, and that's fine, but they're subtle, and they give me a really gritty novel and great dialogue, great suspense, great scene setting, the whole thing. And they aren't beating me over the head with the message. I just get it because it is entertaining, and they're writing what they would like to read, and they're hoping there's lots of other people out there like them.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not easy to do. Some people say, you know, I wrote this stuff, and I tell them, you know, that your premise is wrong. It isn't realistic. And they say, well, it's fiction. I made it. And I say, you know, I'm not saying it has to be, you know, I look in my backyard and see a spaceship that, but if you give me a premise, it can be Star Wars, it can be Star Trek, I don't care, but it has to make sense. The characters
yep.
have to react in a way where I can identify with them. And people talk about, you know, I did research on this, and so I don't want it to go to waste. So I start reading
right.
and it looks like an encyclopedia, and I say, your research needs to be not the main course. The main course is the story and the people and how I can identify with the universal truths of it. Your research needs to be the salt and pepper. You know, it's the
I like that.
Seasoning, not the main course. But that, you know, it's probably too long of an answer to a short question, but to make the universal truths and the bigger message work with the entertainment means you do whatever you do to make sure the person keeps turning the pages, and I think that's identifying with characters and seeing, you know, see yourself in the story. That's what's going to keep you reading the book.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I was reading one book maybe 8 or 10 years ago, and it was a inspirational or religious fiction or Christian novel, whatever you want to call it. And about 100 pages in, I was like, okay, I get it. I'm supposed to forgive people, right? Well, I get to the very end. It's like a 400-450 page book. And guess what the whole message of the book was? You got to forgive people. I was so mad. And not the mad about the message, right? But
Stephen, you're supposed to forgive the author.
Oh, no, I can't take that away from it.
You missed the whole point of the 400 pages.
Obviously.
He did this as a test, and you failed.
I did fail.
You know, I kind of have a controversial view of Quentin Tarantino. My son is a movie director, and I own a little film company. We've done a few little things. But so I recognize that Tarantino is a genius. I don't have any qualms about that. I know, you know, and I can't tear myself away from seeing what he puts out. But, and I probably shouldn't say this in public, but here we are. I think Tarantino is a genius with nothing to say. Because when I watch the movie and I go, wow, you know, it is brilliant what he does, how he does it. But here's what I get from Tarantino. Racism is bad. Okay, I got that point 10 years ago. Can
right.
we say something else? I mean, yeah, I get it, you know. And he loves blood, and he loves violence, and he does it, you know, like a symphony. And I think with all that brilliance and all that technique he's got, can we say something new? And can we, you know, can you give me a, you know, the stories are usually pretty good, too. But that's what I see with some musicians and some painters. The technique is so overwhelming that I'm not getting the story, you know what I mean? And that's what I try to teach writers, too, is you know, get out of the way of your own message. I don't want to be so aware of the artist.
Yeah, in fact, I'm going to write that down. Get out of the way of your own message, and I'm going to give you credit for it.
Now, while Stephen's writing that down, when it comes to telling a great story, and when you start sitting down and thinking about it, are you focusing more like character, plot, the setting, because now that the setting has almost become a character within books, how do you kind of framework it, or do you have any way? You just kind of go into it and just with that blank canvas and just let it flow?
You know, I'm probably the latter, because I'm sort of a member of the Stephen King school of novel writing, where, and I'm sure you've heard this discussion, but it's you're either a plotter or you're a pantser, you know, right by the seat of your pants.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to write as a process of discovery. Stephen says he tries to put interesting characters in difficult situations and write to find out what happens. I mean, he literally says he doesn't plot. He doesn't sit down. Now, he has an idea where he's going.
Sure.
I might say, like my very first novel, I said, I want, oh, there's that fun beep of yours.
There's that beep. The bomb is coming, baby. We are in the middle of a thriller book.
We got to write a novel about the beep that no one
freaking thing beeping, and I've unplugged everything, and I still beeps.
Yeah.
I don't know
where's that beeping beep coming from. You know,
exactly.
But anyway, the elevator pitch for my first novel was simply, I want to write a novel about a judge who tries a man for a murder that the judge committed. Now, it either, you know, the idea either works or it doesn't. So an editor is
right.
either going to go meh, or they're going to go wow. I would read that. But that's all I had. So in writing by a process of discovery, you put the characters on the page and start writing. Now, if you get off on rabbit trails, you got to drag them back in. But you let the characters tell the story, And it's a great out, too, when, you know, a reader writes and says, why did you kill off my favorite character? And then you can say, hey, I write as a process of discovery. I was as disappointed as you are. and I didn't kill him off. I found him dead, you know.
Yeah, we got to find out who killed him now. Let's go on this journey together.
Exactly. I had an experience one time where I had a private detective, or not a private detective, he was on a police force, but he was kind of taking over the story, and he was a know-it-all, and he was good. And he said, you know, we're going to search this car now, but save the glove box for me because that's where the weapon's going to be. So they search everything, and they go, okay, we don't find it. He goes, it's going to be here. He opens the glove box, sweeps it out, and the weapon is not there. And I got to tell you, I was as surprised as he was. I really thought it was in there.
Yeah.
And so now we had to keep going. And that's the fun part, when you really don't know where it's going. And then your stuff does not become predictable, because if you're writing as a process of discovery, the reader is reading that way too.
Yeah,
absolutely.
It's fascinating to me. Dean Koontz is an organic writer. Stephen King is. You are, Jerry. Lee Child writes all of the Jack Reacher books organically. Lori King is. Tolkien was. And I'm an organic writer as well, but I mean, you look at some of these just amazing storytellers from contemporary, but also throughout history, and yet it seems like that's not usually taught, Jerry. I mean, if you go to most writers' conferences and stuff, they'll teach you about plotting out your book, your first act, the inciting incident, all this, but very rarely does someone say, okay, look, we want to teach writing as an act of discovery. And here are some tools to help people, you know, along with that. So I think it's fantastic, and I think it needs to be encouraged even more than it is.
Yeah, and it's ironic, because what changed my life as a novelist and what I think made me write fiction that worked was Dean Koontz's story structure. And he's a guy who doesn't, you know, but it's very basic. He's not saying, you know, inciting incident and then, you know, all this happens.
Right.
But he's got that real basic one where he just says, make sure you plunge your main character into terrible trouble as soon as possible. Everything he does to try to make it better makes it worse until it looks hopeless. And then because of all the times he had to try to fix it, he's growing as a person because his weaknesses are causing some of these problems. But he's, you know, having to work his way out. In the end, not because of God intervening or some miracle or some coincidence.
Right.
He's grown enough to fix it himself, and then, you know, he either succeeds or fails, and that's your book. Which sounds like the plot of I Love Lucy, if you think about it. I mean, I was teaching this one time, and somebody said, that sounds like what I Love Lucy does every week. And I thought, it's true. It works for comedy, too. But, you know, I thought that was brilliant. And what I noticed, too, is that plunging your main character into terrible trouble doesn't mean necessarily that they have to be hanging from a railroad trestle in the first chapter.
Right.
Because if it's a murder mystery, it might just be that there's, you know, a body found somewhere. If it's a romantic comedy, it might be that, you know, something funny has happened, or somebody's got a dilemma. They're late for something, and they need to go to a job interview, and their clothes didn't come back from the cleaners. You know, that's terrible trouble in that genre. And if it's a Elizabethan romance, the main character girl may have two equally suited men who are interested in her. That's terrible trouble. So it doesn't have to be life or death. It just has to be terrible trouble for that genre. And that basic format works, and you can still be a pantser and write by process of discovery. So I think there's a basic structure you can teach people, but you're right. You know, I teach that some people are outliners, and that's fine. That Randy Ingermanson, you know, very carefully plots it out. By the time he finishes his outline, all he has to do is fill in the blanks, it seems like. But you go to the conference, you teach one way, and then you've got people teaching workshops to do a skeleton, you know.
I personally think that, you know, what you just described is spot on. And the more that people understand what lies at the heart of a great story, you know, tension, believability, escalation of the difficulty, the transformation of either the character or the situation or his understanding of the situation. And when you look at all of the way that these forces kind of act together, you understand the movement of a story. You don't really need to sit there and say, I've got to plot it out, because I think instinctively, Jerry, you probably, as you're writing, and you came to that scene with the glove box, and you wrote, well, there was no gun. And you were like, huh, wonder where the gun is. Because there was a part of you that says it's too predictable if the gun is right there, right? Yeah. I mean, and then there's really no mystery to be solved or something. But then as you move forward, you're probably asking, just from all of your experience, some of these questions are, you know, about believability, or how can I make things unpredictable, or, you know, how could I add a twist that maybe other people have to ask specifically, but probably just through, you know, experience you've been able to. And the more we really teach what lies the heart of story, I think people will tell better stories, whether they plan ahead for a certain scene or not.
Yeah, and I think it's intuitive. I mean, you know, most of us of our generation, we were raised on television and movies, and whether we think about it or not, we write that way. We write sequentially. We write chronologically. We tend to write in acts. And, you know, sometimes I'll be writing along. I'll be on page 50 or 75 or something, and I'll get in my head that it's important to me that this person is left-handed or is wearing a red shirt, and I'm thinking, why do I care? What's, you know? And I think, well, if it doesn't mean anything, I can always cut that out when I'm editing. And 200 pages later, it becomes important. And I'm thinking, my subconscious made me plant that there for some reason. I don't know why, but it's fun. And when people interview me, a lot of times they'll say, where do you get your ideas? And how do you do this? And I'm thinking, well, for one thing, I don't try to analyze it too much because I don't want to pick it apart. I'm not sure how it works, and I don't want to get too scientific about it because I don't want to mess it up. You know, it works, and so I'll just keep doing it that way. And one thing that I find most fun about it, there are two things. One, people say, don't you just love writing? Well, there's a lot of things I love about being a writer. I love being known as a writer. I love having written. I love, you know, seeing it come together and all that. But to me, asking people if they don't just love writing is sort of like asking a marathoner at the 20-mile mark, don't you just love running? They're going to flip you off, you know.
They're like, I love to finish.
Yeah, I love to finish. I love to be in shape and all the stuff that goes with that. But do I love running right now? Not really. I'm dying, thank you. And when I'm writing, it's so grueling. And people say, well, I just love to write. I get in there and it makes me feel. And I'm thinking, if you love it that much while you're doing it, you're probably not doing it right. And you're probably not selling either, because it's just freaking hard work, you know.
It is hard. It is.
It's a grind.
Yeah. It is hard.
Yeah. It's a grind.
Then there are times when you're riding along and you're in that what I call the marathon of the middle, where you know, I've done this so many times and I have to look at the bookshelf and say, you really have finished a book before. I mean, this is, you know, this is why you get into it, because I wonder. But then you get to a scene and it starts to work and the dialogue comes and you start getting emotional and you almost rise out of your seat and you start typing faster and you think, this is going to work. This is going to be a good scene. And I was always surprised that it was Robert Frost, of all people, is the one who said, no tears in the writer, no tears in the reader. I would have thought it would have been some, you know, novelist, but but I can identify with it. And when people tell me that scene really moved me, I'm thinking, I was weeping when I wrote it. So good.
Yeah.
I know. That's when you know that it's working and intuitively that, you know, you're really connecting with the character and with the reader and all that stuff. That is when it is fun.
What's funny is, as Jerry just said, he looks at his bookshelf and realizes, oh, I can write. Yeah, that's called a library to Jerry. Most people call it a bookshelf. You can have an actual library of just your books in your house with over 185. And I guess the question is, you know, like you said, it is a grind, and it is hard work, and it is very difficult at times. So what keeps you coming back?
Well, it's what I do. I mean, there have been times, and I hate to be a name dropper, although part of me loves being a name dropper. I have become an acquaintance of Stephen King because we had the same audio reader for years, and the guy had a horrible accident and eventually died from it. But we were kind of supporting him and his family when he was in rehab and stuff, and Stephen found out that I was doing that too, and we went to see him and have just
like him about as many as Brett Favre in sports.
Yeah, and he'll say, you know, I'm done. I finally, you know, I've read my last book, and it's over. And I've noticed that happens to me now that I've done so many. Like after Riven, I thought, you know, I really did think it was my best, and I still do. And I thought, and plus I made the mistake on the back of that one. I don't know if you see it, but I said, this is the one I've always wanted to write, and it stayed with me for years. And I thought, what a dumb thing to say, because what do I do about the next one? This is one I've sort of always wanted to write. But I thought, I don't know if I got anything more to say, and I've done all these, and it's so grueling, and you're done, and you go, boy, I don't know if I want to go through that again. And I remember emailing Stephen, and I said, you know, I've seen you do this before, where you announce it, you say you're done, and then a few weeks later, a few months later, I hear an announcement that you're working on something else. He goes, yeah, resist the temptation to announce it, because you retire, and then you're kicking around, and you're underfoot, and your wife wonders what you're doing, and he said, and then you start getting an idea, and you get the itch, and you really, he said, if you're like me, you can't do anything else, you know,
yeah.
And you get bored. So don't retire. Just, you know, I mean, it's what I do. And
just die with the pen in your hand, I guess, right?
Yeah. I mean, there are things I enjoy doing. I love going to movies, and I love, you know, visiting the grandkids and all that stuff. And my wife and I get along well. But then it's like, really, is this it? I'm not going to play golf and drive around. So
yeah.
Let's get back to the keyboard, you know.
Cool.
Now, I think I recall hearing that you had made acquaintances or friendship with Stephen King, and I thought that was intriguing. And honestly, I have a sense that his work at first was people sort of derided it, or derision or whatever, like, oh, he's just writing, you know, hamburger stories or something, whatever, instead of steaks or whatever. But over time, people have become have started to recognize just the true brilliance of his storytelling. And, you know, even more than ever, I think people are flocking to his stories. What would you say is part of the key to his longevity as a writer and just the attraction that people have to the stories that he tells?
Yeah, I think for a long time he was just considered a horror writer and,
right.
You know, just wrote for the masses. And he, for a while, was defensive about that or would say, you know, I write for the masses. I'm part of the masses, and they like my stories. But I think part of it was that he was so consistent at it. And then people sort of begrudgingly say, it doesn't sell just because it's horror, and that's what people like. It's actually good. And, you know, he's a craftsman. And then as I started to read it, I really love The Green Mile and Misery and some of the other stuff. I love his baseball stuff. We've kind of got an affinity that way, too. But what I notice about it is he's a master at minutiae, the little details. He gets that stuff right. And one of the things that we've talked about, you know, he was raised in some kind of a mainline denominational church. So he... And he doesn't claim any faith now. He doesn't, you know, I'm not trying to make him out of some sort of closet Christian or anything. But I notice that when he does write about things of faith, like a church, he gets the little details right. And most people who are not Christians don't get that right. And it always bugs me. And it's a lesson to me that when I try to write on the other side of the fence, I don't want to assume I know other faiths or other religions or other stripes or just secular life that I'm not familiar with. Don't assume it or write the stereotype. Research it. Because I'll be reading a novel and somebody will say they were going to send their daughter to vacation Bible school if they could afford it. And I'm like, if they could afford it?
It's free or something.
Yeah, that was free.
How much research does it take to figure that out, you know?
Yeah.
But Steve, I
used to get a free snow cone after it all.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you get little cheap cookies and grape juice.
Yeah.
But I noticed that Stephen would talk about Sunday school or you know, something related with the church, and he gets the little details right. And so we would talk about it. He says, yeah, I grew up in that thing, and I do research. Well, he does that for everything, and you get,
yeah.
You know, if he's writing about, you know, like The Shining and writing about a hotel, you know he's going to get the horror, right? Because for one thing, he's making it up, and it's all about blood and ghosts and all that stuff. But he even gets hotel procedure right because he cares about that stuff. And I think that's what makes it work, is that he's a careful writer and a craftsman. And so then he starts winning awards from
right.
from big secular, you know, magazines. And he's still got his critics, but he's quite a social critic too. I love the, you know, columns he writes in magazines about. And I like how he reviews other writers. He's very generous with his endorsements of other writers. And if in that way, because if he doesn't like some, he'll say so, and they just have to take it. You know?
Yeah. Well, I was looking online just, you know, before the interview, and I knew some of your background, and the reviews of your books across the board are incredibly positive. But there are some people out there who are just flamethrowers against you, Jerry. Like, I would like find this criticism or blog or something. And I mean, obviously, you have to take everything people say with a grain of salt, but how do you personally deal with when people, you know, so recently I wrote a book that deals with sexual predators targeting children. It's called Every Crooked Path, and it's probably, I feel like, my most important novel so far, because it's a very contemporary and very important issue, right? And so someone wrote, how could you claim to be a Christian and write a book like this? And I was like, how could I be a Christian and ignore this? You know, this is our world. This is what happens. But I don't like being in that spot where someone would either criticize my faith or my integrity or my convictions or something like that. How do you work through that? Or how do you deal with it? Do you just ignore stuff?
You know, speaking of name dropping, the privilege of a lifetime for me as a nonfiction writer, I was asked to assist Billy Graham with his memoir. And I got about 13 months of off and on interviewing him in his home and his office and stuff like that. And the best lesson I got, besides his just genuine humility and Christlikeness, was we covered the early years when he started to become really popular. And he got criticized for being too ecumenical. And fundamentalists and, you know, conservative Christians would criticize him for having people on his platform. Excuse me. That were not fundamental enough or conservative enough. And he tried to defend himself, and he would say, but these people, when they come to my crusade, I don't compromise my message. And so if I'm respectful to them and honor them and maybe put them on the stage, it might look like I'm endorsing them. I'm not, but I'm welcoming them. And they're going to sit under the gospel. They're going to hear my message. So that's why I do that. Well, people would criticize and say, you're going to go to hell. You're leading people astray, blah, blah, blah. And he said, I finally learned I can't convince anybody. I can't persuade them. I can't argue my point. And he said, I was so hurt. I was so offended because I know my motive. My only motive was to, you know, lead people to Christ and tell them my message that, you know, I believe that Jesus died for their sins, et cetera, et cetera. And he said, I finally came to this realization that all I can do is, you know, a soft answer turns away wrath. And so he showed me the letter that he sends to every critic, no matter what they say. They could use foul language. They could tell him he's going to hell. They could tell him he's leading other people to hell. He's the worst thing that ever happened. Every letter that goes back under his signature to a vitriolic critic says this: dear, you know, whatever the name is, thank you for caring enough to be so forthright. I hope you will continue to pray for me as I continue to try to serve the Lord. Sincerely, Billy Graham. That's it. No defense, no arguing, thanking them for being forthright and asking them to continue to pray for him. And so I just learned to do that. Now, when I got such vitriolic criticism for Left Behind, it didn't get criticism until it was really popular. And then the criticism was always, you did this for the money. Well, I had no idea it was going to be
right.
So
yeah.
Popular. And I wasn't raised in a tradition where, in fact, I was raised in a tradition where you're supposed to be suspicious of money. You don't do things for money. So when it started to roll in, I gave most of it away because I didn't know what to do with it. I mean, you know, you don't do it for the money, so you try to be generous with it. But the biggest thing was I knew Dr. LaHaye. say things I don't say. He might even believe some stuff I don't believe. But he's a soul winner at heart. He's a softy. He loves people. He prays for people, the whole thing. And so I was very defensive for him. And when people would criticize him for that, I would defend him. I'd say, how dare you say that about him? You don't know him. Don't say that about him. He didn't do it for the money. He gives almost all the money away. But for myself, I would answer the way Billy Graham did. I'd just say, thanks for caring enough to be so forthright. I hope you pray for me. That's it.
The one thing that shocks me today is, because I study Buddhism, and so, therefore, you know, I've always been under the belief growing up in Baptist church that religion is a personal choice. And just because people don't believe in the same things, I just don't understand why and what gets in someone's brain for them to decide, you know what, you're doing this wrong and you need to do it my way. And I would never say that to anybody ever, because I have compassion over what everybody thinks and how everybody is. And I just don't get that line of thinking, why someone literally sat down and wrote out a letter criticizing someone's work or someone's passion just because they didn't find it interesting. Well, turn it off. Don't watch it. It's not part of your thing. That's perfectly fine. You don't have to follow it. But to throw out venom, I feel, is extremely distasteful, and I just kind of let it just go by, and just, you know, and I just, like I said, you know, like you said, you pray for the person, you know, I have compassion for them, and it's the same thing, and I just don't get that way of thinking.
Yeah,
I just don't.
It's one of the great embarrassments, and it's not, you know, I mean, if you're a person, you know, like me, I'm a person who's a Christ follower, and I don't think that's how he is. I mean, he's a person who would forgive and accept and say, he would pray for people. He wouldn't condemn them for that, you know. So, you know, I believe that Billy Graham is a Christ-like person, and so he doesn't defend. He just says, hey, thanks for being forthright. Pray for me.
Yeah, I think social media has, and I always call social media a weapon of mass destruction, because it has come a lot more, it's brought a lot more venom out of people that before, you had to see them face to face or talk to them on the phone, but now you don't have to. Now it's everywhere, and people can just spout off everywhere, and it's creating this world of hate, and I don't like it. I don't think, and it's like everybody thinks that they should be able to have their opinion and spew it in a way that is just, it's so hateful,
yeah,
and I feel so bad.
I
you know,
that,
I always thought, you know, people always say, well, how do you view yourself? You know, is the magazine a success? Is the magazine a failure? And this and that. I said, you know what? I said, success and failure are judgment tools that other people use against yourself. I never look at myself as a success or a failure. I look at myself as a person that's just doing what I know how to do. And that's it.
Yeah, I like that. I think that the people who are so vitriolic with the anonymity of the internet are the same people that we knew as kids who were vandals.
Yep.
Throw rocks through windows at night or draw something on the sidewalk. You know, if you got something to say, just face us and say it.
Right.
You know,
right.
It's cowards that are vandals. So this is our modern day vandals are the anonymous people on the internet. Yeah.
Right. You know, but you know what the good thing is, and Kevin O'Brien does this, is that he goes on Amazon and he looks at the person who writes the absolute worst review of his book, and he takes that person, and that's who he kills in his next book. He goes, he goes, that's just therapy.
That's great.
Jerry, in the next few minutes, I was hoping you could tell us a little bit about connecting with your guild, your training institute that you've instituted, the one online that you mentioned earlier. How do people get connected, or what's the best way for people to, you know, learn from you? I mean, obviously in 50 minutes we can cover aspects of the story, but really to get deeper and to take our stories to the next level.
Yeah, I blog frequently at jerryjenkins.com, but then we've got a 10-day window for enrolling in my Writers Guild, and it's just Jerry's Guild, JerrysGuild.com, and just until next Friday, we we've got this little window of, that you can sign up. And, you know, just go to that site, and there's no obligation. You can just check it out. But it's we have all kinds of stuff that we offer there. I do master classes where I interview people on Skype. I've got a manuscript repair and rewrite where I actually edit on screen and show people why, you know, I edit the first page and tell them why I make all these changes and decisions. I even did one of my own manuscripts on there to show how I edit my own stuff. We have what I call office hours, where once a month the members can call in and talk to me live and ask questions. So all kinds of features. We've got 15 hours of archive material. We just started this in January, and I hoped that a couple hundred people would sign up, make it worthwhile for everybody. We had almost 1,200 people sign up in the first enrollment period, and so this is the second enrollment period of the year, and we just started a couple days ago with this 10-day window, so there's still plenty of time, but just through next Friday, so this is a propitious time to do it. Through May 27th is the enrollment period.
So when people sign up and they become involved in this program, now I know in the past year you had a conference. I came and spoke at once or twice, but
yeah.
Do you guys still do the conferences, or is it mainly just the online program these days?
This is almost all online, and we are planning for some live conferences, but right now everything you need will be online, and I think that what people will find here, especially what's already up, is so great, because I've interviewed like Don Miller, the girl that used to be the editor of Writer's Digest and is now a consultant.
I don't know. I know who's the current editor there, Jessica, but I can't remember who might have been that Writer's Digest in the past. I'll probably think of it as soon as we're off the air.
Yeah, she's actually a friend of mine, and I'll come up as soon as I'm...
I have no idea. I remember Jessica. I remember Jessica, and I remember I met... I think it was a guy, and I met him at Thriller Fest, and then he was gone like a year later, and so then Jessica came. I totally forget what his name is.
Yeah, Zach, I think, but...
Maybe it was Zach. That was it, Zach.
Yeah.
That was Zach. Yep.
So, but you interviewed some of these professionals and...
Yeah, I interviewed them for what I call master class, and they're similar to what you're doing right now, and we do this on Skype, so they're on there, and it's... And as I said, the manuscript review and rewrite, that is a cool thing because I use a program that records the session. You see the editing on the screen while I'm talking about you know, all the various changes, and I explain them as I go. That becomes people's favorite feature because they see, instead of getting a letter that says your writing doesn't meet a current need, they're seeing actually what would happen to make it work.
Yeah, nice, excellent. Yeah, we do. I do some similar stuff. I've never done anything online, but I do a little bit of that sometimes when I teach. And you're right, people love the practical. Oh, okay, now I start to see the picture because, you know, it's hard to find good teaching, you know, about writing. And
Jane Friedman, I just remembered her name. Jane's really great. She's consulting on electronic publishing and that type of thing. And I did Chris Fabry. Chris Fabry was a syndicated radio host as a daily program, and came to me one time and said, you know, will you edit my writing and bring me along? And I get a lot of people that do that, but he really seemed sincere, and I looked at a little bit of his stuff, and it looked great. And so I started editing him. I said, this is going to be painful, but if you take it, you do that with some people, and they get that look in their eye like, well, I really wanted to be discovered. I didn't really want to be edited.
Right, right.
And he wound up writing 35 of the Left Behind books for kids. We did 40 books in that series. He wrote 35 of those, and then he and I did 15 children's books together in another little series, and then five other ones. So he and I have done 50 books together since. So he's one protege that actually, you know, came through. I interviewed Doc Hensley that runs the writing program at Taylor University in Indiana.
Yep.
And Diane Mills, the fiction writer.
Yeah, I know.
Brandon
Diane
Collins.
I taught up for Doc 1 week up at Taylor University Crime Writing Forum. That was fun. He's a big fan of yours too, by the way.
Well, he's such a house of fire. I mean, that guy really, you know, you listen to him speak, you got to fasten your seatbelt, you know. And I'd love to have you on sometime, talk about suspense writing. It's going to be great.
Yeah, we'll do it. That sounds good. Now, Jerry, you're so prolific that it's a little hard to keep track and keep up with what your latest project is, but we want our listeners to check out your books. Obviously, we've mentioned a number of them here, you know, during the show, but do you have any new releases this summer or anything that that people could rush out or now order or pre-order?
Yeah, the one that's coming out May 31st is called The Valley of the Dry Bones. That's the one that's
set
in dystopian California. And I had a lot of fun with that one. It's you know, it's this little band of 16 people that decide to stay in California, even though the government has condemned the state, and only 1% of the population remains because they just can't afford to move. You know, they're indigents or they're Native American tribes that can't leave, and so this little band stays. They have to live underground because the sun is unrelenting and the state is virtually uninhabitable. They stay to kind of minister to these people, and mayhem ensues. So
that's our favorite kind of story, isn't it, John?
It always. I love mayhem.
Well, anyway, Jerry, I really appreciate your time coming in and sharing your thoughts and just getting a glimpse at your heart. And, you know, if I don't take anything else away, just kind of the ideas that you shared about dealing with criticism, doing so gracefully and with tact and honoring the other person, I mean, that's very classy. And I think that's great advice for all of us who are in this thing. And we hear from people, you know.
Well, I appreciate that. I'm a big fan of yours, and I appreciate you having me on.
Yeah. Excellent. So everyone who's listening, there's information about our novel writing intensives at novelwritingintensive.com. And of course, more guests and more broadcasts at thestoryblender.com. And please do check out the other episodes of Suspense Radio and Suspense Publishing that John puts out. And as you do, always remember,
the art of the story is all in the blend.
We'll see you next time.